This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
From roughly 1346 to 1353, Europe was paralyzed by the most fatal pandemic in recorded human history, the bubonic plague. This disease was caused by a deadly bacteria that lived inside the black rat. It infects a part of the immune system called the lymphatic system. It's believed to have been transmitted to humans by infected fleas that were feeding on infected rats. The disease also took the form of a pneumonic plague, which infected a person's lungs and was easily spread through the air. There was also septicemic plague, which infected a person's blood. If you got the plague in any of these three forms, your chances of survival were slim. The plague killed more than 60% of the total population in Eurasia. One city that was hit especially hard was Florence, Italy. In just the first 4 months of the pandemic, their population was reduced by almost 80%, and the city spiraled into chaos. People began to fear one another. They abandoned their families and friends and locked themselves inside. Funeral practices stopped. No one was working. It was a complete collapse of society. This is the backdrop of Giovanni Boccaccio's Decameron, a collection of short novellas completed in 1353, just as the plague was ending.
If there's an ethic that one can extract from Boccaccio's Decameron, I think it revolves around Boccaccio's vision of what storytelling does for human beings and how ultimately necessary it is in the grounding of human relations.
Boccaccio recognized the important role storytelling played in human life, and he offered a new take on the age-old tradition.
His prose, what he did to the Italian prose, became a model for Italian literary history in prose for, you know, to this day, you could say. And what his what he did to the short story, he didn't invent the genre of the short story, but in a sense, you could say that he's the inventor of the modern version of the short story.
Welcome to Writ Large, a podcast about how books change the world. I'm Zachary Davis. In each episode, I talk with one of the world's leading scholars about one book that changed the course of history. For this episode, I sat down with Professor Robert Pogue Harrison to discuss Giovanni Boccaccio's Decameron. Boccaccio was born in Florence, Italy, in 1313, and spent his early life between Florence and Naples.
And he lived through the bubonic plague in Florence and lost his father, he lost his stepmother, he lost a number of his friends, and he witnessed firsthand the ravages of the plague. And a year or two subsequent to its recession, he wrote this Decameron, which has as its frame the plague 1348. And it begins with, in the introduction, with a rather long description, clinical description of the symptoms, of the sort of reactions that people had, the different medical theories about what was causing it, and all these various remedies that were proposed, all of them ending up being feckless. And he evokes this complete collapse of his society, where all the institutions and even the religious protocols and so forth just give way to a kind of social anarchy, as it were.
There are 10 narrators in the Decameron, 10 young people living in Florence at this time. They, too, have seen the horrors of the plague and have lost family members to it.
And they decide that they need to respond in order to save their own psychic well-being to the situation. And they decide to take a two-week sojourn in the surrounding mountains of Florence in beautiful garden settings with villas. And for 2 weeks, they engage in merrymaking, song, dance, but above all, storytelling.
They end up in an abandoned villa in the town of Fiesole.
Members of the brigade very deliberately go to the margins of Florence in order to reconstitute in an almost ideal form the forms of conviviality and neighborliness and social ordering that would, in their case, maximize the two-week sojourn in order to give them what I would call an immune response. This is not just a psychological immune response to the plague, but a social and even quasi-political immune response. It's actually a co-immune response because it's a community response to the collapse of community in the city. And one of the primary immune responses is storytelling that Boccaccio presents as having a very therapeutic and society reconstructing power of it.
While they're out in the countryside, they decide to entertain themselves by telling each other stories.
So the Decameron presents itself as the 100 stories that this brigade of 7 young women and 3 young men would tell over the course of 10 days. That's what Decameron means. Boccaccio gets it from the Greek, Decameron, and over the course of 10 days, each of the storytellers narrates one story a day for a total of 100.
So let's go a little bit more into the stories themselves. What are these stories like?
Well, every day has a theme, with the exception of the first day. And keep in mind that there are these 10 members of the brigade. They take turns being the king or queen of each day. And it's the king or queen who decides the basic theme. Stories with a happy ending of love or unhappy or moments of generosity and so forth. It's a great variety of stories. And it's difficult when you have 100 stories that are not only about different topics, but seem to convey different visions of what virtue is and what vice is. It's very hard to subsume the Decameron under one story. What Boccaccio does by putting all these stories in sequential order is that he's always shifting the perspective on reality and thereby reminding us that there is no one privileged view of what the real is or should be.
By giving each storyteller equal power, Boccaccio levels the playing field. He isn't claiming that any one perspective is better than any other. There is no one true perspective. This idea of shifting perspectives was commonly represented in medieval times through the theme of fortune. In ancient and medieval Europe, many people believed in a goddess called Fortuna, or Lady Fortune. She had a large wheel of fortune, similar to the kind of wheels used in watermills. The different locations on the wheel represented different states of being, and a person would move around the wheel throughout their life.
Fortune, blindfolded, is the one who she turns her wheel, and the people on the top of the wheel of fortune with their wealth, eventually, you know, with time, everything will circulate in a way that shows that you have your perspective, where you stand on the wheel of fortune is always a question of perspective. And Boccaccio, through his Decameron, he's kind of turning that wheel of fortune through the various stories that make up the 100 stories. And show us what it's like to be an aristocrat in one case, and, you know, a servant in the other, a woman versus a man. So, yeah.
Boccaccio also used this perspective shifting technique as a way to comment on the various religions of his time.
And he does it with a very clever story of a father who, leaves a ring for the favored son, and that ring gets reproduced in perfect simulation. So each of the 3 sons has a ring that they say, this is the real one. And the others are simulacra. But there's no objective way of establishing which is the authentic and which is the copied. And this is how Boccaccio provides a kind of allegory for the Abrahamic, I say the Hebrew, the Christian, and the Muslim religions, in order to, leave things open for plurality, without having to make that gesture of finding one single truth that must prevail over all the other truths.
In other words, there might not be a single truth, even in religion. But even if there is, stories won't necessarily communicate it. Storytellers might spin the story in whatever way suits their agenda. This is what Boccaccio's first story is about.
The first story of the Decameron is interesting because it's about the worst scoundrel who ever lived, Ceperello, and he gets misnamed Ciappelletto. On his deathbed, he engages in a false confession to a priest, and he presents himself as the most virtuous person who had ever lived. And upon his death, the priest goes and gives a sermon and chastises his people for saying, oh, look at how holy this man has been. And the rumor starts spreading that Ciappelletto was a saint, and everyone rushes to get relics and things of that sort. And this is the first story of the Decameron where Boccaccio is warning us about the dangers also of storytelling, because you can end up sanctifying, you know, the most vile individual, morally vile individual who had ever lived, because we don't understand. And he said, God will know who deserves his rewards and who doesn't. But here in our human world, we are within the perspective of the sublunar, a world of appearances, where we can never be completely sure what is true and what is not true. And storytelling has a way of also promoting falsehoods that we buy into. And we know that in our own day and age, if you know, ideology often takes the form of stories. And each ideology has to tell, has a master narrative that does the work of persuasion, no? So Boccaccio, I'm particularly fond of that story, let's say more for doctrinal reasons, in the sense that it's Boccaccio warning us, okay, you're in for 100 stories, but let me warn you that storytelling is not always an innocent activity.
Storytelling isn't always an innocent activity, but it is necessary. And being necessary, it is important to be good at it. He stresses the importance of this skill in a story told on day 6.
The first story of that day is a story about a knight. They're out on a kind of countryside excursion. And on the way home, one knight tells the other lady, even though they're on foot, look, can I take you riding on my horse? Let me tell you a story that will put you on a horseback. Anyway, he makes such a mess of his story and can't get the sequence right, and always saying, oh, I read that. The lady starts perspiring and is suffering through the bad storytelling, and then through a little witticism, telling him that, sir, you know, your horse jerks, and please, you know, do me the favor of putting me down from the horse.
The knight quickly gets the message and abandons the story.
This guy is a bad storyteller, and it's a moral flaw of his virtue. So storytelling becomes a kind of social virtue. In day 6, there's a truly humanistic vision at work in Boccaccio's Decameron, where he's always has his eye on how the important thing in life is not so much to save the soul of your fellow man, but how can we help each other get through the day? How can we add to the pleasure rather than the misery of life in the everyday modes? And conviviality, generosity, gratitude, the virtues of the proper use of language, all these things are kind of the more modest humanistic virtues of Boccaccio.
Boccaccio lived during the early years of the European Renaissance, when humanism and humanistic virtues were gaining popularity, especially in Italy.
If you had to sum up or define Italian humanism or humanism in general, what did it mean to the people at the time who were developing this way of thinking? Why did they choose the word humanist, or, you know, what did it come from?
Well, humanitas belongs originally to the sphere of education. It was a certain kind of humanistic education of what we would call arts and letters. What we even speak about the liberal arts is really what humanitas referred to originally. And so it was a curriculum.
Part of the Renaissance humanism movement was reviving the study of classical antiquity. Before the Renaissance, the church held most of the power, and the primary form of education was scholasticism. Scholasticism incorporated the supernatural and was built on spiritual faith. Humanism emphasized human achievement and reasoning. The idea behind humanism was to create an educated citizenry that could engage in civic life.
The Italian tradition of humanism begins largely in Florence with this so-called civic humanism, which was more of a political view of humanism as a form of government that in which the people or the citizens had sovereignty rather than a king or the prince.
This was very different from the other city-states in Italy at the time. Typically, a city-state was ruled by an authoritarian prince. The prince had almost all the power, and the citizens had very little. In Boccaccio's time, Florence was ruled by a council made up of 9 men. The council was re-elected every 2 months, and its members were chosen at random. This system of self-governance was a point of pride for Florentines, both real and fictional.
The Decameron has 10 members of the brigade. They take turns being king and queen. No one is the king and queen for longer than a day. It enacts in an allegorical way the values of the civic humanism of Florence, for sure.
So civic humanism, which sounds more like a republic form of government, requires capable citizens who can make choices together. And therefore, you need really good public communication skills, presumably to give speeches in front of, you know, councils and members of the community.
You have to know how to persuade your fellow citizens of the opinion or political policy that you're proposing. And eloquence flourishes in these moments of republican-based forms of government. And that was certainly the case also in Florence, where rhetoric or eloquence was exalted as primarily, first and foremost, a political virtue. No? How can I persuade my fellow citizens? Boccaccio belongs clearly in that civic humanism, and in addition to which he belongs to a different kind of social, or what I would call civil humanism rather than civic humanism, which is the problem of human relations with my neighbor and the enhancement of those relations.
This was humanism on the personal level.
Boccaccio's humanism is not the triumphalist humanism of the Renaissance, which took human beings to be the authors of their own destiny and the great heroic enterprises of the anthropocentric view. He had a humanism of humility, where the human condition is intrinsically fragile, it's vulnerable, it is to be human largely means to be in need of help. And he says that in the preface to the Decameron, which begins with the word umana cosa è aver compassione degli afflitti. It is a human thing to have compassion for those who are afflicted in moments of distress. The other way in which the Decameron is humanistic is a human comedy is, again, as we've said, it focuses on our human limitations, what we can know and what kind of truth we can have access to. But the heroes and heroines of the Decameron tend to be people who are not the passive victims of circumstance and of the abuse of others, but who find a way to act in situations that are highly determined, where the right act at the right moment, the opportune moment, can lead to consequences very different than had you not acted or had not acted in the right way. And therefore, they are heroes of a certain kind of humanistic call to action.
Now, the challenge of the ancients is that it's an authority different than, equal to, or maybe sometimes superior to the church. So could you tell us a little bit more about what does the Decameron say about the church? What's its approach to the Catholic clergy, to Catholic life. I mean, a lot of it seems extremely satirical and, you know, not particularly respectful of Christian teaching and leadership.
Oh, no, it's absolutely a mockery of the institutional corruption of the church. I think the second story of the Decameron is about a Christian who's trying to persuade his good friend Abraham, who is Jewish, to convert to Christianity in order to save his soul.
Abraham decides to indulge his friend and travels to Rome, the headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church, to get a better understanding of the religion. But once he arrives, he sees the Pope, bishops, and cardinals acting in disgraceful ways.
Much to the friend's astonishment, the Jewish Abraham decides to convert to Christianity because he says, if, you know, the representatives of God can be, you know, this sinful, then there must be a higher truth to it, because this religion has managed to thrive despite the fact that it has the worst kinds of representatives in it. So he just took that as an indication that it would be a good investment, you know, to convert to Christianity.
Other ways that this text is modern, I'm curious about, parts of it do seem to me proto-feminist. The fact that there's seven female narrators compared to three, the fact that there seem to be stories that talk about how brilliant and amazing women are and how capable they are. Could you speak to this aspect of Boccaccio's thought?
Most of the heroines in the Decameron are really remarkable kind of proto-feminist figures who show that they are in every respect equal to their male counterparts. They have the intelligence, the discernment, use of language. And let's not forget that the Decameron is dedicated to women because of Boccaccio's understanding that most of the women in his day and age lived within the confinement of their own rooms because they were subjected to the will of their fathers, brothers, and husbands. And they needed the consolation of literature, because they did not have the male privilege to go out and pursue entertainments that distracted them from their own dread. So there's a kind of celebration of femininity. But then when you get into the stories, you find that the women are in every respect the equals, and in some respects, you know, the superiors of their male counterparts.
Is it fair to think of the Decameron, I don't know, as the first modern book? I mean, is it kind of, does it usher in a new modern perspective that we still see in our societies today?
I think that's a very fair characterization. This book has had an enormous sort of reception in the West.
Because of the plague and the earlier Crusades, there was a shift in the Italian economy. When Boccaccio was writing, Italy was moving from a farming-based economy with feudal lords and an underclass of farmers to a trade-based economy with a new class of merchants. These merchants made their money selling food and supplies around the Mediterranean. The merchants were able to grab more power and influence than the farmers ever could. As a result, they rose in the ranks in society, sitting just below the noble class.
How many of the stories have to do with merchants? A great number of them. You also have stories about the aristocratic class, but mostly we're talking here about the new mercantile reality of the Naples that Boccaccio spent time in, and also Florence, obviously. So here it's like a mercantile epic for a new modern era, which Boccaccio understood is going to be dominated by money rather than, you know, power, or where money is now becoming the new currency of power.
This marked a shift from the power of the nobility to the power of the self-made merchant. Boccaccio often depicted the heroes in his stories as having similar qualities to these new merchants.
Thus, many of the heroes are part of a middle class, an entrepreneurial middle class, and oftentimes their actions have an entrepreneurial aspect to them that the merchants clearly responded to very positively at the time.
And how was he received and read over the centuries?
He's less celebrated now and maybe even in the 20th century than he ought to be. The Decameron, not only as a whole, but many of its individual stories have gone through many different iterations and rewriting and retellings.
Over the years, there have been many adaptations of stories in the Decameron. It impacted some of the most canonical European writers, including William Shakespeare and Geoffrey Chaucer.
He has had an enormous literary influence across the ages that has rarely had the big ups and downs of people who come into fashion and out of fashion. Our time is ripe for a revalorization of the real greatness of this masterpiece.
Boccaccio recognized how timeless and important stories are for society. They give us new perspectives on life and offer up lessons to help us deal with our complex worlds.
Where would we be without stories? If you think of any human society, it's storytelling is the real foundation of the social and communal identity of different cultures. It's the way in which values, the founding values of a community, are also reaffirmed and dramatized. The conflicts that arise invariably in human relations find expression in stories. And therefore, what at first glance might seem like a light entertainment activity on the part of the brigade to go and tell stories to each other for 10 days actually has a very serious ethical component to it that I personally very much appreciate in Boccaccio's vision of what can we do in order to enhance the relations we have with one another and the role that our use of language plays in this enhancement.
Yeah, it makes me think about how the plague, it cuts off human life, literally because of the bodies dying and decaying, but also without social life, you can't have a true human life without the exchanges, without the expression. And you can see that, I think, even in our own time, like, we are hungering for that same kind of connection with other people. And it feels like a kind of death to be socially isolated from one another.
The absolute fundamental human need to reconnect socially with one's fellow citizens is as important a need as even any biological medical need we have. And Boccaccio is well aware of that.
Writ Large is produced by Galen Beebe, Jack Pombriant, and me, Zachary Davis. We get help from Liza French. Our theme song is by Ian Koss, and our branding is by Dan Pecci. We're a member of LitHub Radio. Writ Large is a Lyceum original production. Join our discussion room in the Lyceum app to share your thoughts and hear what other listeners are saying. You can also find us on our website, writlarge.fm. There, you'll find transcripts, links to the books we discussed, and more information about today's guest. Thanks for listening. See you next time.